The original guide to men's health is moving to a monthly release schedule. We will be releasing new episodes the first Wednesday of each month. We really appreciate you listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode. A baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. In this episode of the original Guide to Men's Health, we're going to be talking about COVID-19. I wanted this episode to fill in for our listeners who may not have a science background, who may not be well versed in the terms of things that they hear about viruses, who may not have read up on viruses or this particular infection. So we're actually going to be setting the stage with some background information and filling in perhaps some areas that people had questions about. Helping us do that is Dr. Paul Pottinger. Dr. Pottinger carries an MD degree and a diploma in tropical medicine and hygiene. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine, Division of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, director of the Infectious Disease Fellowship and Training Program at the University of Washington. He's co-director of UW Medical Center's Antimicrobial Stewardship Program. Dr. Pottinger, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much, Rich. It's good to be here.
So I have an interest in helping people who are listening fill in a little bit of background that some people may say, oh, I know that, and other people may say, I'm not so sure. And I really want to start with basics between definition or a virus and a bacteria.
That's a great question. I love it. Starting with the basics is always the right way to go. A lot of people get confused between viruses and bacteria, including healthcare professionals. So it's a great question. Viruses, bacteria, they're all part of the same family, what we call microorganisms or microbes. Micro just meaning small, meaning that they're too small to see with the unaided eye. You need a microscope to see them. They are actually different from each other. Bacteria are a very ancient group of microorganisms that have been around on our planet long before we existed, and they will be here long after we kill ourselves off, I promise you. In fact, they're on us. They're in us. In fact, most people have as many bacteria on them and inside their intestines as they have cells made of themselves. So we are as much them as we are us, which is a little creepy, but actually it's good because they're beneficial in so many ways. Bacteria typically are harmless, often beneficial, helping us digest our coffee. You know, they're important for good immune health, etc. But unfortunately, sometimes if they get into the wrong place, or if they pick up bad habits, they can make us very sick. Bacterial infections include bacterial pneumonia, bacterial skin infections, bacterial urinary tract infections. In fact, for just about every compartment of the body you can think of, there is a bacterial infection that comes along with it. That's what I do for most of my time. My day job is fighting those bacteria with antibiotics when that's appropriate to do, and helping other doctors make the right choice. That's bacteria. Viruses are a little bit different. They're actually much smaller than bacteria, and in fact, they're much more primitive. Bacteria have a lifestyle and a personality all their own. Bacteria will consume nutrients. They eat what we eat. Sometimes they eat us alive. Viruses are different. Viruses are all about getting into our cells, getting inside of our body, and using our own cell machinery to reproduce themselves. So virus is much more simple. It's more insidious. And that means it's also, in some cases, more durable in the environment, and in some cases, also more changeable. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the point is that viruses, again, are usually quite harmless, or if they cause an infection, it's a small thing. But once in a while, they will get into the wrong place at the wrong time, and that can cause anything from a mild cold, that's a viral upper respiratory infection that's caused by the rhinovirus, not the rhino you get at the zoo, but rhino meaning your nose, and then it can be something even more serious, such as COVID-19, which we'll talk about. A lot of viruses out there, hepatitis, something that goes to the liver, for example, poliomyelitis that goes to the spinal cord. There's many different parts of the body that can be attacked by either bacteria or viruses. But the key difference is that viruses do not respond to antibiotics. That's a huge deal. We have a lot of antibiotics, not as many as we need. That's good for treating bacterial infections. But for treating viral infections, our ability to treat someone with a specific medicine is much, much more limited. We have some good antiviral medicines for HIV, for herpes viruses, but that's the exception. Most viruses today do not have an effective medication. So with viruses, it's all about prevention.
So again, that's a key point. The bacteria can reproduce by themselves. They don't need us. But viruses need a host. Now, it doesn't necessarily need to be a human host. In fact, as we go into COVID, what got us into trouble is that this particular virus was reproducing in an animal or a bat host, and has migrated from the animal kingdom to humans.
That's what it looks like has happened with the SARS-2 coronavirus, the COVID virus. We still have a lot to learn about how that happened and whether that happened in the wild or in a man-made environment. But what you're talking about is very true. Viruses need to be inside of some sort of eukaryotic or human animal type cell. Bacteria, not necessarily so. Some do, but most of them don't.
So in terms of the virus having access to the host to be able to reproduce and whatever else it does, how does it do that? It gets into a cell, and then, so we're going to talk about a little genomics background.
It's all about the genomics. Genomics is the field where we look at the genome. The genome is the DNA or RNA blueprint for any creature, virus, bacteria, human being, monkey, whatever. That's your genome. So that's the blueprint that makes us who we are. And in human beings, for example, our DNA blueprint is, well, our genetic blueprint is made of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. That's important because DNA, it's in virtually all of the cells of our body. We have those copies. Half of it came from mom, half came from dad. And we will carry that forward with us in virtually all the cells of our body for every day for the rest of our life. And that's important. DNA is extremely, extremely good at being reproduced with perfect precision, almost perfect precision. DNA is truly a blueprint in that it is the source of truth. And it rarely changes. When it does change, that could cause cancer. That could cause no harm at all. And sometimes we actually need to change the DNA when we're making sperm and egg, for example. But generally speaking, DNA stays the same. DNA works because it's the code for the protein that makes our body. In order for DNA to make our protein, our skin, our bones, our eyeballs, it has to go through an intermediate step. That's called RNA. Ribonucleic acid. And ribonucleic acid is very important. We can't live without it. It's how we move from the blueprint over to the producted thing. It's sort of like, if you think of DNA being the computer code and then your laser printer is your RNA, what you make on your laser printer, your 3D printer, that's the protein. So RNA, we need it. We have it. It is designed to last a very short time. RNA is not important that it be absolutely perfect. In fact, when it comes out, it is more error prone. In our bodies, that's okay. We have a surveillance system in our cells to chop up and recycle RNA if it is abnormal. Unfortunately for us, there are some viruses that use only RNA. That is the way that they store their genetic information. That's really important because it means that those viruses are more likely to change or mutate every time that they reproduce. That's a big deal because it means that these viruses, as they change, Our immune system has to keep up with them. Our vaccine technology needs to keep up with them. Our very testing that we do needs to keep up. So RNA is a big deal. It's a healthy part of our bodies, but when it's in a virus, it can be a real challenge.
So there are some viruses that we see as infections that I think most people obviously have heard about. Flu virus, HIV, the herpes simplex and zoster, chickenpox, measles, polio. We have seen viruses in the past. We'll continue to see them in the future. And for the ones that cause us harm, we have worked on therapies. So if you look at the ability to take a flu virus, we try to predict which version of the flu virus is going to be attacking the population from year to year, because it's not all the same virus, right?
Yeah, flu virus has been around for a very long time. The name influenza, that's the real name of this flu, is influenza. It's an ancient Italian word meaning the influence, because in medieval Italy, they thought that that influence was coming down at us from the heavens or something like this, that it was a curse. And having said so, it really is a curse. It has killed so many people, not just in the great pandemics of 1918, but every single year until 2020, every single other year that we have ever recorded and tracked it, influenza has been a huge killer of human beings. For some people, they just can't work for a week or can't go to school and they feel rotten. For others, it can be a deadly situation. So we're very, very mindful about flu. And every single year, we talk to our colleagues in the Southern Hemisphere, especially Brazil, Australia, and also in the East, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, looking to see what strains or variety of flu is there, because we know that that flu tends to come to our country with a predictable seasonality, cold and flu season, right? That's your winter time. And so that's what we do every single year. This has been an interesting year for us because flu has gone away. We can talk about why we think that may be true. But the point is, in the case of flu, we have a vaccine technology. It's okay. It saves lives every single year. That vaccine technology is not perfect in flu for a variety of reasons. It's cumbersome, it's expensive, and it doesn't work as well as we want it to. But it is an important way to try to keep people healthy, keep them at work, and keep them alive. That's a different story from other vaccines. Think about the measles vaccine, where you get that shot and you are good for life. Think about the poliomyelitis, polio vaccine. You get one polio immunization and you are pretty much guaranteed to be good to go. So viruses, they are all very different from each other. There's tremendous variability in viruses. Some of them are easy to make a vaccine for. Well, I beg your pardon, none of them's easy. Some of them are easier than others. And some of them will get a more durable, long-lasting immunity. And that's one of the amazing challenges and, I think, incredible advances with COVID-19.
And then there are some viruses that we still are stumped. HIV. We do not have a true vaccine for HIV prevention. We have antivirals, which you may just want to delve into momentarily. There is a distinction between a treatment with an antiviral medication versus a vaccination.
That's so true. HIV has been revolutionized in terms of prevention, because we now know that if people take a pill a day, they are extraordinarily unlikely. If they take it as directed, they basically won't catch HIV. But that still requires you to take a pill a day. That's not a small thing. We would be so benefited by a durable, safe HIV vaccine. HIV, unfortunately, is a very tricky virus. It's called an RNA retrovirus. And the point is, it infects the very cells, these CD4 T lymphocytes, those very cells that normally help us make an immune response. And that's why it's a slippery customer. There are many careers that are being built and played out trying to make a vaccine. I am so grateful to everyone who was working so hard on this, what I think is presumably the greatest scientific problem of our age. And yet we do have so many other viruses that are out there for which we have no vaccine at all, and we're not even trying, because generally speaking, they don't tend to kill people so much. And so I think it's an interesting question about viruses. How do we choose what to make a vaccine for? How do we make that vaccine? And how do we really know that it works? These are important questions that we continue to work on every single day.
Just to carry this a little further before we start focusing on COVID and just being more general about vaccines, vaccinations, and viruses. When we look at eradication, trying to get rid of something, if we vaccinate enough people, we can prevent the virus from finding a suitable human host, presumably?
It's such a great question. Yeah, the E word, eradication. That, to our knowledge, to my understanding, that's only happened once in our history. That was smallpox, which is, I think, very poetic because actually smallpox was the first very, very serious, potentially deadly, very disfiguring, disabling viral infection. That's the first one that we actually made a vaccine for. This had probably happened in antiquity in other parts of the world, but in England, Edward Jenner worked on this by taking something called cowpox and inoculating it into the arm of a, whether he was a willing subject, I don't know, but a young boy who was at risk of getting smallpox. And that boy was protected. That's an old technology where we use one virus that's similar to another and let it grow inside the patient. We don't routinely immunize most Americans for smallpox any longer because smallpox is only in human beings. There is no animal reservoir out there. And it is a very, very effective vaccination. I think it was 1977, if I'm not mistaken, when the last recorded case was identified. Tragically, it was one of the people doing the work of smallpox vaccination. But the point is, that is a shining example of what can happen if everything lines up right. Only in humans, a serious problem, a highly effective vaccine, and a world population that was so, so eager to do this because they had seen their children disfigured this way. They had lost loved ones. People were willing to pull together, get immunized. And you're right, we put that one to bed. I think there's still some stock in Atlanta and Moscow, apparently, but basically there's no more human smallpox, thank goodness.
So for the vast majority of viruses, we vaccinate to prevent death, to prevent dissemination, dissemination that's readily passed around as the world would be without a vaccination.
I think we have to be choosy about what we decide to vaccinate for. Let me give you an example. Most Americans will have two or three episodes of upper respiratory viral rhinosinusitis, a common cold, every year. I get two or three of those colds a year. Not in the last year, which is an interesting caveat, but generally speaking, most Americans will catch a cold several times per year, and it just sucks. It's a bummer, but it rarely, rarely kills anybody. So although it's incredibly common, and although it spreads like wildfire, we don't choose to immunize against it because the individual health implications are not so huge. To be perfectly honest, I would love if there was a rhinovirus vaccine. I would gladly take it because I hate that stuff. On the other hand, there's other stuff that is much less common, but extremely, extremely dangerous. That's true for some viruses. It's true for some bacteria. Bacterial meningitis, a real scourge and a threat to the young people of our country, teenagers, young adults. It's a rare infection, but when it happens, that can be a huge impact on the risk of survival, brain damage, etc., in that person. So, yes, I think we have to be choosy about whom to vaccinate and when to vaccinate. Ideally, it should be something that's catchable, something that is preventable, and something that's going to harm the individual.
So let's review how most vaccines work. How are they constructed? The technology to date for most vaccines was?
There's been a couple of different techs that have gone into vaccines. The point of any vaccine is to give a harmless, small dose of either an infection or a part of an infection, so that the immune system can see that in a controlled environment, so that instead of getting overwhelmed and fighting for survival, there's no risk to that individual. The recipient of the vaccine knows that they'll be safe, but their immune system gets just enough of a glimpse that it can start to make an immune response and hopefully hold on to that response for the rest of the days of that person's life. Some of those vaccines are built with whole cells, what we call a live attenuated virus, for example, where we take the organism of interest and we poison it, we cripple it. Maybe we hit it with chemicals to denature some of its guts. Maybe we hit it with radiation to make it so that it is less virulent, less likely to make someone sick. In other cases, because that's a very problematic technology and an older tech, in other cases, we'll engineer things to only show the portions of that microbe that are most important for the immune system to see. For example, there's an extraordinarily important vaccine we now have to prevent genital cancer in men and women. This is the human papilloma virus. HPV is what causes the great majority of cervical cancer and a lot of penile cancer as well. We can give someone a shot, a very quick series of injections, and virtually eliminate the chance that they would develop those cancers in their lifetime. It is stunning. There's no live virus in those vaccines. It's a viral-like particle that is reassembled with microscopically small lipid balls and the proteins and different portions of that HPV virus that are not harmful, they can't reproduce, but they show themselves to the immune system, and it works very well. So the traditional vaccines coming into the modern 2020 era, there are different kinds, and they're different because some are for viruses, some are for bacteria, some are live attenuated, some are killed, some are engineered. What we've done most recently is something that's very new, which I think is important to talk about as well.
So that, of course, leads us into modern vaccination for COVID, and we'll be reviewing COVID, but go ahead and talk a little bit about the COVID vaccine structure with the mRNA.
COVID, this coronavirus infectious disease of 2019, or COVID-19, it's caused by a virus called the severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus number 2, SARS-CoV-2. That virus is an RNA virus, and it's one for which we have not had an effective vaccine before. If I'm not mistaken, I have actually lost count, but if I'm not mistaken, we have more than 20 vaccine candidates that are still very much in development. So it's a fascinating time when it became clear that COVID-19 was such a huge threat to our species, to our way of life, to our economies. When it became clear that we really needed a vaccine, there was a huge amount of interest in the scientific community and in the business community to try to figure out a solution to this. Some of those solutions use older technology, and I don't mean older to be bad. I mean something that is more proven. For example, engineering a part of a protein, the spike protein on the surface of a COVID virus, that it would then put into a viral-like particle and show to the immune system. But then there's a new technology as well. And here in the United States, where I live, we have two vaccines that are currently approved by the Food and Drug Administration for prevention of COVID-19. One of those is made by Pfizer and BioNTech, and the other is made by Moderna. And both of them use the technology of mRNA, which is an exciting new tech.
So explain a little bit about how that works.
We talked about this a little bit before. If RNA is the important way that information is transferred from the backbone or blueprint into protein, you know, the thought that some people came up with, I think in the 1970s at MIT, which is a fascinating story in and of itself that I'm just becoming familiar with now, but someone a long time ago came up with the idea to say, hey, what if we build our own RNA in a laboratory? We can make the exact RNA that we wish, and we'll make that RNA so that it encodes or gives the instructions for the part of a virus, a bacteria, some sort of invader, but just the part that's most important to make an immune response. And what if we take that RNA and put it into a human being and force the human being, the patient, to use that RNA to start to make those proteins? It's a very brilliant concept, and I'll tell you why. Building the protein itself is the traditional way in which some vaccines are built. It's very laborious. It is hard for us in a laboratory to express the correct amount of protein, the correct shape or conformation of protein. Building proteins is something that we can do in our laboratory settings. We're just not great at it, whereas RNA and viruses are really good at it. That's what viruses do. So the concept was, let's take a little bit of RNA, we'll make it just the way we want for whatever virus or bacteria you choose, a very designer process, and put it into the human body and force the body to make these antigens. The protein of a foreign substance that the immune system sees is called an antigen. And in response, our body makes an antibody. The antibodies hopefully will neutralize and destroy that antigen. So that's what was done. The reason we didn't have this back in the 1970s, and it's taken us a lifetime to get to where we are, is it's really hard. RNA, messenger RNA or mRNA, it's very delicate. The human body loves to destroy RNA. It's recognized as a foreign substance or a piece of garbage, and boy, we have a great recycling system in our body, and it loves to chew up mRNA when it sees it. So the big tech was not only the idea to make a customized piece of mRNA, but also to deliver that mRNA in a way that protects it, that gets it into the cells of our body and allows those cells to start making that process before recycling and destroying them. That's what we have today in these two, I guess you'd call them competing vaccines. I call them two heroic vaccines, but they're both built on this mRNA technology.
So we'll come back to this because we have so much to talk about, but I think we'll emphasize it now and emphasize it again when we come back to it. But this mRNA vaccine does not change your DNA. It doesn't make you wake up tomorrow a different individual and start producing something very strange.
You know, it's funny that you asked that. No, it's very safe. It doesn't work that way. I have a couple of perspectives on that. That's always been a concern since the very first vaccine we had against smallpox, like we talked about before. And in fact, if you look at newspapers and political cartoon publications in England hundreds of years ago, there are cartoons of people growing cows out of their knees and off their head because it was a cowpox. So it's understandable that people would worry about that. But no, of course, that's not the case. RNA is a one-way trip, right? You can't go back to DNA. There are some viruses that do this. They're called retroviruses, but you need something called reverse transcriptase, an enzyme that would actually take RNA information and put it into DNA. Humans don't have reverse transcriptase, so that's one of the things I really like about this tech, is it will never touch your God-given blueprints of your DNA. It's quite safe that way. And I would also emphasize, it's a funny situation, but you know, I got my second vaccine just yesterday, almost exactly 24 hours ago. And so I'm here to tell you, yeah, it works well. I am feeling it. My immune system is rocking. I have some chills, some body aches. My inflammatory system is on the move. And I like that because it means I think I'm going to get a good, durable take.
So it's not a problem. It's not an allergic reaction. It's normal. And you're carrying on a very coherent conversation with me. And I'm doing this actually as we do these on a Zoom platform so I can see you and you look fine. So for people who are worried, I can attest that even though you're describing a reaction, you know, it's a good reaction.
Hopefully I look okay. You know, this has come up, and it does come up each year with seasonal flu. I can't tell you how many friends, family, patients, colleagues I know who will say, yeah, I don't want to take the flu shot because when I take a flu shot, I get a flu. Well, it doesn't work that way, of course. You can't catch flu from a flu shot. If you could, we wouldn't use it. But people may feel a little bit achy, a little punky. They may get this kind of immune reaction. So you could understand why people would get confused that way. Believe me, no one ever died of a flu shot, right? Whereas with influenza, the real infection, it's a completely different animal. And it's interesting. You can tell who's had real flu, because those folks will tell you flat out, no, it's not even in the same ballpark. True flu, you're on your back for a week.
Yeah, and let's venture into COVID-19 a little bit, and then we'll come back to vaccinations. But I think understanding a little background about COVID, it's still with us, it's still spreading, it's still propagating at an alarming rate, it's still killing people at an alarming rate, and I think it's always worth going back to what it is, how it spreads, what do we know about it, what can we do about it besides vaccination? So a little background about COVID-19. What is it?
COVID-19 is a respiratory infection because of a virus, the SARS-CoV-2 or COVID virus. You can call it that. That's fine. That COVID virus spreads from person to person. It is a human infection. And it spreads when we come into contact with the respiratory droplets of another person. Right now I'm talking to you. We're on a Zoom call. So I'm talking into my laptop. And as I speak, there are microscopically small little droplets of spit, sputum, snotlets, respiratory goo that is flying out of my mouth as I speak, and it's splattering against the keyboard. But I'm not a spitter. You can't see this. But it's happening. Even though these are microscopically small droplets, they're there. Now, if I were infected with COVID, and truth be told, I could be. I could absolutely be infected with COVID right now and not know it. That's the problem. COVID is something that can be so deadly serious for some and so completely benign for other people. So that's where we have come into this real issue with COVID-19. It's a virus that is spread from person to person through direct contact, through our nose, through our mouth, and perhaps also, yes, through our eyes. And that happens when we are usually indoors and usually within about 6 feet of an infected person. There are a few exceptions. Can you catch it outside? You can. It's extremely unlikely. Can you catch it for farther away than 6 feet? It's possible. There are examples of this. We do not think it is usually the way. Can you catch it if you wear a mask? And if everyone is masked, I mean, it is possible, but it's extraordinarily unlikely. Those things together, personal space, covering our faces, and only going out if we are truly staying with people who are within our so-called bubble, our family, together, those things work beautifully. And they're not perfect, but if we could simply do them, we could follow the example of other countries as well and make things better. So I hope that that's a good background. I think most people have heard this, but I'm happy to answer more specific questions that your listeners may be sending to you.
I just think it's important to emphasize perhaps the difference between droplet spread and aerosolization. Aerosolization is going to spread virus further than where a droplet could spread. And I think both are recognized as potential means of spreading. So do you want to just delve into that for a moment and clarify the difference between those two?
Yeah, I'd love to. Again, when we speak, laugh, talk, chuckle, when we use our nose and our mouth, when we breathe, we do exhale droplets of different sizes. Some of them are visible. I mean, I don't think I'm spitting visibly right now, but I could be. And sometimes you can actually see that shower of droplets through the light of the day or something. Others are much, much smaller. So there's tremendous variability in the size of those respiratory droplets. The ones that are bigger tend to fall to the ground sooner. They're more readily acted on by gravity. And so within about 6 feet, the big, juicy, wet ones tend to fall to ground. The smaller ones can travel much farther. They're so small that they are light enough that they tend to float with the breeze. That's what we call aerosolization. When we went into this pandemic, it seemed clear that patients would make droplets and doctors would make aerosols. If you come to my hospital and I give you a nebulizer of albuterol, if I give you an oxygen treatment, if I suction your trachea during surgery, I would force you to make these small droplets. And that is still true today. Having said so, it's also become clear that some people will make aerosols even in the normal course of their day. And again, it's part of that reason we've learned this lesson in such a hard way. But it does come back to the prevention side, because the good news is that if we're all masked up, the distance of 6 feet or otherwise is covered. I'll say that again. If you are more than 6 feet away, but you're indoors, you should still be masked. I think that's very important because those smaller droplets that may travel a little bit farther. The good news about those smaller aerosol droplets, they're so tiny, they're so dry, that they do not contain as many viral particles as the big wet honking ones. So I still think that droplets are super important, and I still think that if everybody masks up, the difference between them is really not important.
But that's such an important concept about wearing a mask inside. And, you know, unfortunately, people have had difficulty with masks. This is a public health message. It's not a political message. It's something we do for each other. And I certainly am totally empathetic with people who feel that someone's telling them what to do, but we all stop at stop signs.
I think behavioral change is hard. To be perfectly honest, wearing a mask, I think, is hard. I think we should acknowledge that. I mean, I have rosacea because I'm a mountain climber, and so I just tend to get rosacea. When I wear a mask, I tend to break out, if not in acne, then just an irritated sense of the skin. I don't like it. But holy cow, I would never go without one if I was going to be indoors, if I was going to be within 6 feet at least of anybody else. It is just not worth it. And to be perfectly clear, I just told you I got my immunization yesterday. That mask-wearing behavior will not change, not until everybody else gets their vaccine, because although this vaccine that we have is incredibly effective, it's not perfect. So I am willing to do that because I don't want to catch it, and I really don't want to give it. As doctors, actually, at the end of medical school, we take an oath. I think people probably know this. We do take the doctor's oath. And it says, first, do no harm. We all take the same oath. That means don't hurt other people. And it's part of our ethos in medicine. I think most Americans have the same ethos, too. What a great way to show that by covering up.
So before we move along, though, I again want to go back to another concept that you spoke about and again emphasize this issue of spreading the virus even though you feel totally well. The fact that we are now seeing asymptomatic transmission of up to over 50%.
I think, you know, it's such an interesting situation. If you think about it, this is the sweet spot of COVID-19. And it's, to me, I was so surprised by this. I was not expecting this. But if you think about it, if the virus were much more deadly, if it killed everybody it came into contact with, if everybody felt really rotten, we would not be in this situation. People would take it so very seriously. Think about Ebola virus disease. Ebola virus is another kind of RNA virus. It's quite different. It's called a filovirus. It is usually found in portions of West Africa, and a substantial proportion, in some cases up to half of people with Ebola will die of it. It's a very deadly disease, and I think people have heard the name, even if they don't know the details. If we told them that Ebola was here in the States, they wouldn't think twice about staying away from somebody. Well, the reality is Ebola virus will never pose a threat like that because it kills so many of its patients. For a virus to succeed, for it to propagate, for it to take root and to explode from an evolutionary standpoint, that is success. It has to be something that people feel well enough with that they will spread it to others. And if a small proportion actually die, you know, that virus will still propagate because most people feel okay. So that's the sweet spot that we are in. What you said is true. Most people who have this infection have either mild symptoms or none at all. And unfortunately, that's where we get into that philosophical question, wearing a mask in case I may be infected, wearing a mask in case that person may be infected, without any way to look yourself in the mirror or look at others and know whether it's true.
And people who really have, again, politicized a public health measure, something we're trying to do for the greater good, have said, well, let the people who are most at risk be more cautious and leave the rest of us alone. But the but is, we don't absolutely know who's at risk. Yes, we've been good at being able to identify individuals who are at higher risk, but we don't know everything. So higher risk individuals right now, you can go ahead and delineate those.
People who are at the highest risk of having a bad outcome are those who are getting on in years. And actually, is that 65? Is that 70? Is that 80? The older we get, the higher our risk of having a bad outcome. People who are overweight are at risk of this. People with cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, people who have a reduced immune system because of treatment for cancer or an autoimmune condition. These are the core factors that we worry about most for those high-risk situations. But don't be fooled. What you said is true. We have people who come to our hospital who do not leave alive, and they are young people who we just don't have any reason to think have an abnormal immune system. We have people who come to see us and we save them, but their lives are altered, terribly altered. I hope not forever, but frankly, we don't know. People who used to be an athlete, now they can't climb the stairs. People who used to be a professional person, lawyer, or something like this, they can't keep their practice because of this brain fog. People who used to be able to take care of their kids and now they can't run after them because they get a racing heart rate every time that they go out. This virus has rare effects in some people. And if it were a rare virus, then those rare effects wouldn't be a big deal. But it's an incredibly common virus. So these rare issues actually become a huge problem. And we do not know who is going to go down that path of darkness. Even if it's something like losing your sense of smell, perhaps some of your listeners have been through that. Thank goodness I have my sense of smell. I'm really grateful for it. How would you eat your food? I just think for some people who have been through COVID and are alive, they're grateful for that. And they're just angry that they didn't take better care of themselves because they can't see the way forward. I hold their hand and we walk them through that process. I am optimistic they'll get better. But frankly, some of that is just guesswork.
And we cannot yet identify who those people are.
Correct. And I'm not sure that we ever will. Perhaps there are people who are very smart who are working on this. Perhaps if we knew some profile or portion of your genetic makeup, some sort of marker of your antigen profile, your ancestry, maybe we could do this. I'm dubious about that. The one thing we can't choose is our parents. And so I think the question is, if we, even if we knew that information, how would that really change what we do? We should all assume that we are high risk, and we should all assume that we have it. We should all assume that our actions make a difference to others.
So that, of course, then leads us to, again, the public health dilemma of that versus the economic and the politicization of COVID reality. When would you feel safe going to a restaurant? Wear a mask, it's hard to eat.
Yeah, hard to eat through a mask. Maybe sip a straw or something. You know, I think going to a restaurant, my hope is that by the time we get to next summer, when outdoor dining, at least here in Pacific Northwest, I live in Seattle, and I'm hopeful that by the time we get to next summer, when the weather starts turning super nice, we'll have a lot more people who've been immunized and a lot more opportunities to dine outdoors. I mean, if we had a situation today where we could all sit outside and give each other personal space between our family pods, that can be done today if it's done correctly. Well, I think it would. I think in terms of indoor dining, I am not feeling safe to dine indoors. I just don't see that. Is it possible that a particular restaurant could set up a very safe situation? Yes, of course. If there's a ton of fresh air coming in, if you have plenty of space between you and the next parties, if the staff are all masked, it can be done. I think it's just hard to do. So if you're thinking of dining with others, number one, at the moment we have such a surge of infection, I would urge you not to, or to find a different way to celebrate with others. Number two, when public health in Seattle, King County, or whatever your local municipality is, says things are looking a little better, we're happy with the way the restaurants are doing it, you could consider this if you have to. I think that's a different story. But for me right now, yeah, no, we're not eating at restaurants.
And then outdoor, what is safe? What constitutes safety in an outdoor dining situation?
Yeah, really the same fundamental issue, which is personal space. The nice thing about outdoors is that you have fresh air. And I want to say this because I've seen this pop up in our city of Seattle and nationwide too. Folks, a single-walled plastic tent out on a sidewalk or a street, to me that's not really outside. It's just a tent that is less well climate controlled. It's all about fresh air. So if you have plenty of fresh air that is coming through, for example, literally going outside, not inside a plastic bubble, but outdoors, and there's plenty of space between dining parties, and you know that the people you're dining with are extraordinarily low risk because they're part of your household bubble, that could be done safely. I think there would still be some infections that happen that way, but much, much less so.
And moving away from commercial restaurants, having people over into your dining room who aren't in your personal bubble constitutes the same sort of risk?
Yes, unfortunately, the majority of infections that we are seeing and have seen over the last few weeks here have been in that circumstance. It's holiday time, Thanksgiving, Christmas time, New Year's. People are getting together, kids coming home from college, families celebrating. That has been a big driver of the current surge in cases. So it doesn't matter whether you're paying somebody else or not getting paid to cook for yourself. If you're indoors and you're dining with people who are not in your immediate bubble, it's a risk and a very real one.
And flying on an airplane?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating situation. When the pandemic started, airplane flying, I consider to be the very highest risk for catching COVID-19. That turns out to be wrong, at least with respect to commercial airliners built by Boeing or Airbus, for example. Turns out that they bring in a lot of fresh air, and we now have this real-world experience over the last year, which tells us that if the airliner is not packed full, and if everyone is masked virtually all the time, the chance of catching COVID-19 on an airliner is actually quite small, again, because of the masking and because of the fresh air. The exceptions that have come around typically have been traced to people who have not been fully diligent with their masking or Unfortunately, people traveling knowing that they are infected or knowing that they have a positive test. This is just completely unacceptable, and but that apparently has happened.
Unfortunately, yes. So as we identify or have better ways of identifying acute infection, hopefully we can either have vaccinated passengers who prove they've been vaccinated and feel more comfortable, safe, or better screening. Temperatures, obviously, and a questionnaire, do you have a cough, aren't necessarily always going to find those who are currently infected.
We had thought that temperature screening would make a difference. That tech has been around for a while looking for flu. It did not pan out. We don't currently do that in my hospital, UW Medical Center. We have not found it to be useful. But we do ask people about their illness profile, exposure risk, and we insist that everybody mask up. And that gives us an extremely safe workspace environment.
So again, before we leave masking and precautions, let's talk about one other area, because the kids have obviously had a hard time being schooled at home, not being able to go to class. And yet we have found that children can be spreaders, that they can shed virus pretty readily and be totally asymptomatic.
Well, it's a huge portion. Currently, almost half of COVID infections are spread by people 20 and younger. So it's a huge, and they don't make up almost half of our population. It's been a huge source of spread of infection in younger kids. And I used to be a teenager too. I can remember those days vaguely. And I'm just so impressed with young people who are able to do this. I don't know how I would have handled it. I mean, of course, we didn't have an internet, so you couldn't see people like you and I are looking at each other. I think we had phones, not even mobile phones. So it would have been a super depressing thing, but it's still incredibly stressful. Yeah, I have two kids, one 20, one 16 years old. They're coping with this. It's not easy. And so I really do value the idea of trying to get kids back into school, not just online, but physically there. But that can only be done if the school does an incredibly meticulous job and takes its top-to-bottom look at all of its safety protocols and really does what needs to be done. Short of that, I would not recommend it.
And so it needs to be done. I mean, if they're going to be indoors, now they potentially are shedding from one to another, coming home and shedding. How do you construct a classroom?
There should be no spreading and shedding. I think the most important thing to do is to have a Zoom meeting like you and I are doing now, but with a pod, and just have the parents and the kids meet together face-to-face. It's kind of fun. We get to meet as parents, right? Who are the parents of my kids' friends? It's kind of good to know. But to make a face-to-face pledge, these are the people you're putting at risk. If you break your home bubble, if you do some sort of reckless shenanigans like eating indoors in an unprotected environment, these are the people you're putting at risk. So I think that accountability is what is missing in our society in general. Hello, internet trolls. And I think also when it comes to this issue of COVID, because we just don't see the virus. It's so damn small. You can't see it. You don't know that you have it. It becomes almost a mythological thing. You mentioned the politicization. That's why, because it's an invisible problem. Well, these are very real people. So I think a pledge, and then symptom screening every single day. Probably temperature checking for kids coming into school is something that can be done. In some cases, there might be targeted testing. Everyone, of course, is masked. Physical space is enhanced and much more fresh air delivery into the room, plus meticulous cleaning and hand hygiene. Those things together really can make a difference. I think that can be done safely, but it's pretty resource intensive, and not every school has those resources.
So we'll come back to vaccinations, because that ultimately will be the key that allows return. So we talked briefly, the types of vaccines currently available are and licensed here, at least in the United States, are the mRNA. The attenuated virus is in England available?
Yeah, not exactly. It's not a truly attenuated coronavirus, but there is an adenovirus backbone, the so-called Oxford product, that uses an adenovirus that originally came from chimpanzees. Humans and chimps are pretty close. So AstraZeneca, for example, is using that technology. That's exciting. I'm really eager to get that online here if it passes the smell test and there's incredibly rigorous surveillance and such. What my vision for the future is that we will have different technologies. We'll have different manufacturers, different schedules. It's going to be a potpourri. It's going to be a lot of variety. Now, initially, that sounds crazy, but actually, we've done that before. Polio virus, you mentioned. There's been live polio and killed polio virus, for example. So as long as something is safe and effective, we need to immunize the world. And in order to do that, we're going to need more and more supply. So vaccines are good, more vaccines are better. And I'm really excited to see whether that AstraZeneca product, for example, becomes approved here, I hope, in the very near future.
But there are various ones. Will people be taking more than one type of vaccine?
Probably not. When people are immunized, remember, the immunization schedule for COVID, at least with the two vaccines that we have so far licensed in the U.S., it's two injections in your shoulder, the shoulder of your choice, and they're spaced out by 3 or 4 weeks, depending on the manufacturer, because that's the way the trials were done. If you get one immunization made by one manufacturer in the United States, we would insist that you get your second immunization with the same product, because that's the way it was studied. It is possible that you could be immunized in a mix-and-match situation, but that is not something we're doing in the U.S. Other countries are considering this out of desperation because they may have a dwindling supply of one and not the other. We're not doing that. On the other hand, I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing such an incredibly small fraction of our population that's currently immunized, because we want to do it right. And we should. We just need help from federal authorities to increase that volume of vaccine and increase the volume of logistical resources to get it done.
So let's talk about the safety issues with vaccine, because people are concerned. We talked about the fact that the mRNA vaccines are not going to get into your DNA, but these were developed in clinical trials, and we do clinical trials very carefully. So if you wanted to assure listeners that these vaccines, though put through in a compressed timeline, are still safe, go through that process with people a little bit.
I appreciate that a lot. The standards and the rigor for vaccines is the highest of any technology that I know of in the world, at least here in the United States. If you think about new cars that go on the road, trains, airplanes, look what happened to the Max, whatever they called that disaster. We would never allow that to happen in biomedicine, especially with vaccines. The threshold and the stringency for approving vaccines is simply the highest of any tech in the world. And that's because if we get it wrong and we were to approve a vaccine that were dangerous or have a bad side effect, that would set back the entire public health effort, probably for an entire generation, because people remember when the government gets it wrong. I know I do. I could say a lot more about that. But when it comes to vaccines, we have to get it right. And in this case, we have tens of thousands of people in these trials who have volunteered to get these vaccines and are monitored and watched very, very carefully to make sure that they are, number one, safe, number two, well-tolerated, number three, that they work. And indeed, that's what we have in both of these vaccines. The speed of the approval is unprecedented. There's never been anything quite like this. And so I think some people hear that, they realize that, and it sounds like they must be cutting corners. If it's so safe, how could they do it so quickly? What you will find in the national and global dialogue around vaccines in the coming 1 to 2 years is a reflection back, which is to say, not that this was too fast, but that what we did before was just too damn slow. These companies had tremendous resources, specifically my tax dollars, yours, and all of the listeners here in the United States. So these are tax dollar funded research outfits that were able to simultaneously do a variety of different activities all at once. And again, like I said, because this is an mRNA technique in the case of that particular product from Pfizer and from Moderna, that process of making the mRNA is very quick. Scaling it up to be huge for an entire planet, that's hard. But actually designing the vaccine is incredibly straightforward and much faster than anything else that's out there. Gives me hope for the future. You asked the question of whether we would need more than one vaccine. Truth be told, we might. The coronavirus may change enough so that we might have to get another vaccine. COVID-21, COVID-23. This could happen. If it does, we need to be ready. And I think we need to use this kind of adaptable, flexible, scalable technology for vaccine prevention. I'm hopeful that that could happen.
Let me just ask a question again for listeners who, well, there are a lot of people getting vaccinated now, which adds to the safety profile. Is somebody going to contact you in 6 weeks and say, have you been sick?
When you get immunized, you can volunteer, and I recommend that everybody do this. Volunteer for the CDC's app. It's a web app called V-Safe, V for vaccine. And when you have your immunization, you create a free anonymized account that's linked to you, not by your name or your address, but by a unique digital identifier. And you just tell it how you're feeling. And every single day, I get a little text saying, hey, Paul, it's time to check in for V-Safe. You click a button. You tell it how you're feeling. If you're feeling well, there's just one or two questions and you're done. If you feel poorly, and today I do, it actually asked me a whole bunch of other questions with about 15 different symptoms. And if I didn't see what I wanted on there, I could enter my own symptom. And then, is it moderate? Is it small, medium, or is it a big side effect? Did I have to see a doctor? Am I able to work today? All of these side effects are being tracked. Now, that's exactly what happened already for the tens of thousands who were in the clinical trial. They were interviewed and tracked very carefully. This is the first time that I know of in human history when every single recipient does the same thing. So what we are doing, I consider myself to be in phase four. Phase one, phase two, phase three are the clinical phases of the trial. Phase four of monitoring, it's when it's out in the wild. And I'm doing that, and all of my colleagues who've gotten the vaccine are doing the same. So this is, without question, the most effective, well-tolerated, safest, most studied vaccine in human history. I think if the virus we were fighting wasn't also deadly and crushing our economy, maybe people could be back and forth, am I going to get it? This one is a no-brainer. You got to get vaccinated. And I think the big kick in the shins is that at the moment, people who really want and need it cannot get access to it because the supply is not there. I'm hopeful the next administration will help fix that.
I want to ask about a couple of things. One is people have asked, will I need to get a booster to next year?
We don't know. The vaccine's only been around for less than a year, and so that information will come along in time. Based on the antibody level that's made, what we call a titer of neutralizing antibody, I'm actually optimistic that vaccines boosting will not be required, but it's possible. And we won't know that until time goes by and we continue to monitor people, not only if they're getting sick, but also how much antibody is still in their system. So it could become something like your seasonal flu shot. I hope not, but it's possible.
And then you referred to the fact that we might need future vaccines for COVID-21 and such. These are mutations or variations of this current virus. How do we track that? How do we know that there is now a predominant mutation or strain out in the community?
Yeah, thank you. Mutations are so important. Every time the virus reproduces and buds away from the human cell, it may contain errors. We talked about that RNA is more error-prone. It sounds like a defective virus, but it's the opposite. This makes the virus so much more stealthy and so much more likely to succeed because most of the errors during the reproduction process will kill the virus and it'll go away. But once in a while, something will come along that makes it even more fit. This is called natural selection, and Charles Darwin described this back in the 1850s, and he was right. He didn't even know what viruses were, but he knew evolution. And so the key is that viruses change. They always do. Influenza changes, right? Other RNA viruses do as well. And that change is something that we need to track. Currently, the ability to track those changes is something that the United States could do better with, and it will. We have a new director of CDC. We have public health authorities who get it. Here, for example, at University of Washington and Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, and Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center, world experts and real leaders in this idea. The way you do it is you test somebody for COVID, and if they have it, that dreaded nose swab, then instead of just looking for a little piece of the COVID virus for a positive or negative result, the entire genome, that blueprint, is sequenced. It's that sequencing process that gives incredibly detailed information about all sorts of mutations, all sorts of mutations. Very, very big data, a lot of information coming in. It takes computers and very smart doctors to run those computers to figure out which mutations might be important and which ones might be less important. And at the moment, this is something that we are working on. I think you're going to see more and more labs doing it. It's more expensive and time-consuming than regular COVID testing, but it's still important.
And then I know people who have been tested for antibodies and found they had antibodies, may not have been sick, do they need to be vaccinated?
Yeah, good question. What we are telling people here at UW Medicine is that for people who have had COVID-19, we're asking them to consider a delay of 30 days between their test and when they get immunized, because it's unlikely that you'll get infected again within 30 days. Remember, when you get COVID-19, you will make antibodies. The problem is those naturally occurring antibodies are usually not perfect. They're not as durable. They don't do as good a job as the vaccine-induced antibodies. So we're telling people to wait 30 days because we're just trying to get more and more people immunized. But yes, ultimately everyone should, and I hope will be, immunized, regardless of whether they've had COVID, regardless of how sick they may have been with that infection.
So when you said everyone, that brought me to my next question. Are there people who should not be vaccinated? Do they have an underlying condition? Somebody who's had a transplant and is on a immunosuppressive, or somebody who has CML or some other type of underlying malignancy. Who should not get vaccinated?
That's a great question. With vaccines, there are two fundamental questions. Is it safe and will it work? So is it safe? Yes, safety is fine for those people you mentioned. Actually, for the two currently licensed mRNA vaccines in the U.S., the big safety concern is an allergic reaction. Those mRNA molecules we talked about, they are packaged in a very unusual way, which is a proprietary series of ingredients, including something called PEG, polyethylene glycol. PEG is something that people may have been exposed to before. We use it in laxatives, for example. It's a very harmless, sterile, non-absorbed material that is slippery, and it helps people poop in a more slippery way. And so that, believe it or not, is part of the sterile ingredient that goes into the vaccine. A very small fraction of people may be allergic to that or other ingredients. This is very uncommon, but as we do more and more immunizations, you may hear about allergic-type reactions. In order to figure this out, at the moment, we tell people, please do not get the vaccine if you've ever had an allergic reaction to another immunization, or if you're allergic to that ingredient called polyethylene glycol. These are rare, but there are a few people who would fit into that category. And then for the effectiveness side, that's the people you're talking about. Folks where we have intentionally, or because of cancer, where their immune system is not working. Those folks were not included in the clinical trials we talked about because we didn't think they would mount a good immune response. It was not felt to be in their best interest. My hope is that we will learn in time through well-done clinical studies that those people can be immunized very safely and that they may be partially protected. I happen to think it's a very safe thing to do. The effectiveness is the question. And so when I counsel people like you're talking about, for other immunizations, not just COVID, but pneumonia, shingles, whatever the case may be, usually I tell folks, we'll give you these vaccines, but please, for goodness sakes, make sure that everyone in your household is also immunized. I call that a ring of protection because I think that loved ones, family members, well-wishers, they should all have their own good immune system because the person at the center, the immune-suppressed person, they may not be able to mount that immune response. You know, another question that we get as we see more immunizations rolling out is people saying, look, if I've been immunized and then I get it really exposed, let's say a household member who's not immunized comes home with the COVID, but I've been immunized, what's my risk? Could I have not only no clinical illness, but could I actually have a little bit of COVID that I might shed around to other people? And the reality is that as of today, the end of January 2021, we don't know the answer. We strongly suspect that people who have been immunized will either not shed the virus or will shed very, very little. This just makes biological sense. But those data aren't there. The registry trials for FDA and European Medicines Association consideration, they followed these vaccinees for clinical illness. Did you get clinically sick? That's important because that's what we care about. And by the way, nobody who received either vaccine of the mRNA flavor was severely ill. None of them died. But there were still a few mild illnesses. And that suggests that some people, especially people who are relatively immunosuppressed, people who are a little bit older, the definition of older is older than me. I'm 52, so that's always the way. Anybody who's probably in their 60s or 70s, as we get older, those people may shed the virus. So if you've been immunized and you are then heavily exposed, we would still advise that you would quarantine, that you would isolate yourself, not go back to work, not leave the house unless you have to, and be very, very diligent with your masking if you do choose to leave, because you might still be a threat, a much smaller threat to others, but it's still a possibility. Now, that guidance may change come February, even March of 2021. We're really eager for the answer to that question. It really gets to the heart of the matter. I've had my vaccine. Can I travel? Can I go to a bar? Can I go to a show? Can I go to a hockey game? At the moment, the answer is no, but coming soon enough, as soon as everyone in America gets immunized, that is, of course, ultimately the goal.
And again, I'm going to just emphasize something that we spoke about, but after you've been vaccinated, you still need to take precautions.
Unfortunately, it's true. And again, ideally, ultimately, that's going to go away. Otherwise, why the hell would we do it? But we will do it and keep our precautions going once a certain amount of the population is immunized. You've heard a lot about getting to 70% immunization. My goodness, can we please go to 99%? Let's get everybody immunized so that even if your chance of getting COVID is small, it's going to go even less because there's less virus out there.
So that's one takeaway. Get 99% immunized. Any other takeaways before we wrap up?
Yeah, thank you. I so appreciate it. I think what I would say is that the vaccine, well, COVID-19 is a very real infectious disease. Unfortunately, it has been politicized for reasons I can't really fully fathom, but don't make any mistake. It's a real issue. And although most people are fine with it, some will be very gravely injured or not survive. Today, as we're speaking, there's about 400,000 Americans who've died of this infection over the last year. If I'm not mistaken, it's almost exactly the number of U.S. service personnel killed in both the European and Pacific theaters in all of World War II. The number is so big that it's hard to wrap our minds around. If you have friends in healthcare, nurses, doctors, pharmacists, ask them about their experience with this. In rural America, in big cities, in the North and the South, the East and the West, in the very heartland, it's extremely real. This is a deadly situation, and we so appreciate everybody's personal responsibility. It's a hassle to do these things. They're not expensive, but they're not fun. It makes a difference. If you do these simple preventative measures, you will take care of yourself, your family, and in fact, the entire community. We need to get there through a vaccine. It's coming. It will not get here fast enough. Now is the greatest threat we have ever had from COVID-19. It's such a depressing thing to say as we have vaccine rolling out, and a beautiful, very effective vaccine. It will not come in time to get people out of wearing their mask, unfortunately. For the time being, please do what we know works, and we'll get through this together.
Well, Dr. Paul Pottinger, thank you so much. I know this was a lengthy interview. I hope the listener stayed with it. I hope we provided enough background information for people who are uncertain as to what all this was about. But I think we covered it pretty well, so I thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And you know, if any of your listeners have questions, I hope they can get a hold of you through the podcast, and I'll try to get back to them.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Pellman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit wsus.org or visit your physician or care provider.